Well, I'm going to turn it over to Nick, who's going to turn it over to Bill, who's going to turn it over to Carl, and I get to go on vacation for a while here. I'll just push buttons.
All right. Today, Bill Whitaker and I are going to talk about the expeditions, but not just those in one location, but the ones that take place at the same time in different locations. And hopefully what we might learn in trying to explain the relative advantages of the various sites for DX. De-expeditions have a long history. The taking of receivers and antennas out to a superior and usually remote listening site have been described in the literature for many years. My first one was actually in Westport, Washington, over 25 years ago. Interestingly, there was one person in the audience who was there, Nancy Johnson. So, people go back a long way in this hobby. But my recollection is that there were others earlier, names like John Clements, Mort Meehan, and Phil By the Way tells me Phil By the Way, and 29 Palms spring to mind, so maybe some here remember some of those earlier de-expeditions as well. And beverage antennas were the favored in those days, and coastal locations, if possible. So available real estate was a primary requirement, as transoceanic stations were the target of choice. Okay, just a few of the sites that I've DX'd from myself over the years, but others have used many more, especially once it was realized that good DX could be had with antennas smaller than beverages as long as the location was a good one and that was not always next to the ocean. For example, one of the ones up here was in the Rocky Mountain foothills, and the number of stations from New Zealand and Australia we heard were, in some cases, better than the ones we'd heard on the coast. If we had everybody's de-expedition sites, we'd rather flood this map. I know of three in Utah, for example. The Grayland Motel, this is sort of something to conjure with. It's the go-to site for Northwest DXers. It was discovered by John Bryant in the mid-90s. It has room for antennas, even small beverages. It's right on the Pacific Ocean, dry, warm, and with extremely tolerant hosts, usually guests as well. I was there just a few weeks ago with six antennas and a full house of guests. For the most part, were extremely interested in all this wire work that was sitting out between the motel and the ocean. The manager of the place basically said, well, if they don't like it, they can suck it up. And she doesn't even listen to the radio, as far as I can tell. Note to any planning to visit Grayland Motel, wives often will not find it as charming as you might. Next slide, please. Grayland itself, the motel there, has been used by DXers for well on 20 years now. But nothing good lasts forever, and it is getting electrically noisier. And, of course, what if it closes? Sites other than Grayland have produced good DX. And how do such sites compare with each other? DX depends on conditions, so one can't really compare sites based on de-expedition loggings made at different times. As DX conditions vary day by day and even hour by hour, sites need to be compared at the same time and date. And particularly in the past, this has been difficult to do without serious pre-planning. Now, past parallel de-expeditions, we've actually had ones where we did do the serious pre-planning, and my gosh, I had to dredge in the old memory banks to try and bring up some of those. In October 1989, Bruce Portzer was DXing north of Ellensburg, and a crew at Pembina Forks, which included local name references again. We had Nigel Pimblett, myself, Don Moman, and Larry Huchuk. And we compared notes, actually, as we were DXing via scheduled 40-meter amateur radio link. Unsurprisingly, Ellensburg heard more northern Asiatics on its beverage than Pembina Forks did up in the foothills of the Rockies. But a couple of Japanese appeared at Pembina Forks that were not at Ellensburg. And then, whereas October in 1995, and this was a comparison that was more between coastal sites, one at Sombrio Beach, B.C., and the other at Grayland, Washington, with fairly similar results from each site. We did, for example, both hear a little pipsqueak 5PA from South Australia on 1161. But there were more Aussies on the 2,000-foot wire at Sombrio Beach, just because compared to the 500-footer at Grayland Beach. and more Asians at Grayland, but we had no Asian wire at all at Sombrio. At that point, we had no simultaneous communications. And actually, the nearest thing to real time we had there was the reports to the same edition of DX Monitor from the two sites. Of course, that was several weeks later. The Pembina Forks one, we both reported to DX Monitor, but they were in separate copies. So you had to have, there was your parallel the expedition, one copy, another copy. Next. We're looking at a fairly wonderful picture here, of a place on the west coast of Vancouver Island called Tofino. And I was thinking when I put this one, I said, my gosh, you know, like the Tofino Chamber of Commerce should probably give me a retainer for putting this one up so far away from home. It really does. Yeah, it looks tropical. It isn't. It's the west coast and the northwest coast of that. But it is actually a really beautiful area, even if you rarely see it looking like that. One good reason to look for new sites is to cut down on travel time to the old favorites. For me, Grayland is 10 hours away. It involves a ferry ride as well as a long drive. And if I could find a site comparable to Grayland on, you know, sort of on my island, it would be certainly preferable. For me, Grayland, sorry, is there, okay, all right. And I'd really like to know whether or not they're comparable DXing locations. There was an opportunity to DX from there while Bill Whitaker was in fact down DXing at Grayland. So I took the opportunity to borrow a house from somebody that I knew lived up there or had a holiday house up there and do it accordingly. Okay, so were they really equivalent sites? Not exactly. Grayland, we had the Perseus receiver. Tofino, I had the Net SDR. Now, those who have compared the two receivers side by side say that they are pretty much comparable, so we're hoping that that part was comparable. But at Grayland, there was a DCAS antenna, which was being described yesterday in the talks, placed at 290 degrees. It was using a Flag 100 amplifier, and at Tofino, there was a smaller antenna, the Flag, which was placed at 270 degrees, also using a Flag 100 amplifier. These are not entirely comparable antennas. We'll find out more about whether or not, you know, we can actually call them comparable in a few minutes, but supposedly the Flag puts out somewhat more signal than the DCAS, but it's at the expense of a somewhat poorer front-to-back ratio. And, you know, a wider front lobe. Both antennas were placed close to the beach. Grayland, I'm not exactly sure how close, but I know at Tofino it was placed within a few meters of the beach. The difference, and I think it might have been an important one, was that Grayland it has a nice open area, and there are no trees or anything around there, so it's really exposed to the sky. Whereas here, I was basically having to sort of fit it in between houses, and in among trees, and you can sort of see the picture there. The wire is sort of concealed. You know, it didn't offend the neighbors, but my gosh, it may have offended the DX, so I'm not sure. So we'll look at a couple of maps of, you know, like, of the respective areas. Grayland, you can see this nice open water path, 180 degrees western water path to Japan, eastern Australia, New Zealand, you know, just nothing there, Pacific Ocean. So that's the upside. The downside, if you look carefully, you see the magic words Seattle and Portland over relatively flat country. And both of those cities are full of medium wave stations that have nice sideband splatter, and you will hear them if you just put out an omnidirectional antenna. Both the antennas used at Grayland are often the directional, you know, unidirectional, looking out towards the ocean. But at medium wave, that's, you know, it's pretty good with the DCAS, but it would be nice to be even better. And then we're looking at Tofino from bird's eye view. This has, the upside is, it's hidden from the major centers by the mountains of Vancouver Island and the Olympic Range. Essentially, you know, it really feels a little isolated there when you turn on the radio. The big cities are on the other side, and all the major cities of those mountains, and all the major cities except for Vancouver, BC, are further away than they are from Grayland. The one big problem downside, is that the land path north of 290 degrees is a block to, you know, good Asiatic reception. And there's a number of nearby islands dotting even the open water. So the other downside, as you saw from the picture in the last slide, is that there really isn't much room for big antennas there. It's cramped. Essentially, that area there is a collection of sort of almost semi-suburban houses, you know, a country or suburban road with backyards facing the beach. So there's a suspicion that Grayland might have the edge on the Asians. Even a signal arrival from 300 degrees crosses nearby islands, you know, as you can see with this signal path to Japan. And there's at least 25 miles of path skirting mountainous land before hitting open water. So now we had two sets of SDR recordings. This allows us, how are we going to make that comparison? We now have the ability to make quite a bit more scientific approach to the comparison of the sites, because we can compare recordings of the band side by side. But that actually caused a new question. How the heck are we going to do this? You know, we came up with the possibility, well, maybe just the absolute number of DX stations logged in a given time period. And that's a possibility. Actual signal strengths of the number of target stations, this becomes a bit of a head-scratcher, actually. Even with a software-defined radio, this is not entirely easy. And the other conclusion was making up some form of a visual representation of band conditions of signal strengths that would be easy to understand without going into the heavy-duty arithmetic. Okay, let's consider absolute number of DX stations logged in a given time period. When sites are fairly close in capability, your number of stations logged from a certain area in a given time frame is a reasonable method describing not just signal strength, but the quality of the DX site, how strong the interfering stations are, local noise, etc. Particularly in the pre-SDR days, this number might also depend, however, on a DXer's skill of, you know, actually listening at the site in real time. With the SDR, this certainly can be a useful measurement tool, but we have to compensate for different fading patterns at each site. We need to listen across a given time period, not just a specific few seconds across the hour when the IDs are heard. Yeah. Not hearing a site on the hour in a single channel at Tofino when it was heard at Grayland is meaningless because of these fading patterns. Not hearing the station at least as well within, say, 2 to 4 minutes on either side of the top of the hour, on the other hand, that could be meaningful. For me, realizing that I'd heard a station well at Site A, but not at Site B at a specific time, means going back to Site B's files and doing a quick scan over a few minutes at each site. If you don't hear that target signal at least as good strength during that time period, then you sort of say Site A is the winner. If you do, but Site A actually had solid strength the whole time period, Site B just faded up once to that similar signal level, you still say Site A wins. But it's a method of comparison. And do we really ignore signal strength at each site over the period? I think if we're going to be scientific, we can't. All right. This isn't easy. You can see a varying signal, you know, like the actual carrier. The beauty of DXing AM signals is there's a carrier. You have something to hang your hat on as far as signal strength is concerned. Unfortunately, you have interference as well. And part of what you're seeing with that spike that's jumping up and down is the interference level. Sideband splatter can drive it as well. You're going to need to average a few strong signals, not just ones that just occasionally pop up above that grass, that noise floor. You need to find a few strong signals over a specific period, average them, and that'll give you a better indication, I think, of the quality of each site, as long as you have really comparable receivers and antennas. Because you could say, okay, well, you have a lower signal level at this site, but you're using a poorer antenna. So, of course, you're going to have a lower signal level. You'd have a lower signal level at a good site with a poor antenna. So neither Bill nor I going to do this at short notice, not unless someone's coughed up some funding and maybe an advanced degree at the end of it. it's perhaps too challenging to address right now. But I mean, just this week, I've been having trading emails back and forth with Chuck Hutton, and saying, "Well, how the heck we do this? You know, I'm sure you can do it." As usual, we're trying to push it off to somebody else who we think is much more skilled at it. Visual representations of band conditions at each site. This was when Bill and I were discussing this, and actually, I think this is not a bad way of doing it without actually going into the heavy-duty numbers. We often actually comprehend visual indications much better than the rows of numbers, and software-defined radio waterfalls can give you a good idea of potential DX signal quality. With the same receivers and software at each site, visual site-by-site comparisons should be possible. And I'm not talking looking at pictures of the site. I'm talking at looking at pictures of the, you know, the displays of the DX as it happens. Stay tuned for a description of just such a visual comparison from Bill Whitaker. I'll let him do he did the heavy lifting on figuring this out. I'll let him do the heavy lifting on describing it. Yeah, okay. Comparison of Asian DX from Grayland and DeFino. With dissimilar radios and antennas, we simply looked at the number of loggings for each one time period, 1500 UT on 19 February of 2015. Okay, here was the comparison. Grayland, expertise here, 64 Asian stations. DeFino, 23 Asian stations. There was never any Asian heard from DeFino comparable to Grayland's receptions. I also double-checked this by listening a couple of minutes either side of the hour. Many channels Bill had something, even if it was just time pips, when I had a carrier, if that. The only consolation was I had a few weak Australians at DeFino that really weren't heard just then at Grayland. All right, here's a comparison, DeFino to Grayland. So let's try DeFino first. Okay, is it still there? Okay. Not strong. And even the local splatter was definitely trying to get it. Okay, let's try Grayland. Right. Now we're talking, eh? Next slide, please.
Frequency should be 1134.
1134, you're quite right, thank you. There's actually...
Neil?
Neil, yes. And there was also another error that I discovered last night. I didn't want to sort of get Mark's, you know, worried about making changes at the last minute. So, right, thank you very much. This is not as historical as it looks. Okay, so next slide, please. Now, Grayland generally suffered more domestic splatter, though you wouldn't know it from that last slide where I actually had more splatter on the DeFino cut. So you could say then that the more readable signals in general at Grayland were not due to the better signal-to-noise ratio. Grayland had more splatter. It just had stronger signals, too. Even if I turned up the volume on my files until the splatter was as loud as Bill's, that didn't bring up any DX underneath the splatter, and certainly nothing equal to it. As signal to noise and readability are what DXer treasures, it's really important to be able to define this. The different propagation at different sites, is partly going to be, it's going to be determined by our signal to noise ratio. One of my notes here has gone astray. Even the post-sunrise Asians were better at Grayland. There was a good post-sunrise enhancement at DeFino at some of the upper-band Japanese commercial stations, 1242, 1332, 1422, etc. We compared 1242 at 1604 UT, not the 1500 that's on here. That was the error I found. And again, good though the signal was at DeFino, it was still more solid at Grayland at that time, better than practically any other reception I had at 1242. So please play the 1242。 Okay, you can hear a pretty reasonable signal there. We got local noise at Topino, and that was a problem. But now listen to the one at Grayland. And
okay.
Okay, you can hear splatter, sideband splatter there. Yeah, it exists. It wasn't on the Topino file. It doesn't matter. It's really riding over it. It's wonderful. All right, next slide. We suspected that Asian reception might have been better from Grayland than from Topino, due to the land blockage I talked about earlier. But weren't at least down under stations comparable? There are water paths to Australia and New Zealand from both sites. But no, they weren't. This is, to me rather worrisome. In spite of the disturbed geomagnetic conditions on February the 18th, down under stations weren't particularly dominant overall, but Bill heard 12 New Zealanders at 0800 UT, and I heard one. What's going on there? Bill, even with checking either side of the hour, he also heard Tuvalu on 621 better than I did, despite being fairly close to a domestic on 620. Given the water path to New Zealand and the Pacific Islands from Topino, I would have expected better. Hawaii was heard better at Grayland as well, but that turned out to be partially due to less interference from California. On the 19th, I had, on 900 kilohertz, Bill had Hawaii's KMVI dominant with KIKAI on 990, while I had Fresno on 900 and San Francisco on 990. This surprised me until I realized that the other downside to Topino is a fair bit of a water path to much of California. So really, the nearest comparable signal was, I had to dig up something, was 4RN on 792, which is from Brisbane, Australia. So let's try it at Topino first, please. Boy, splatter comes through better on that one. Okay, let's try Grayland. Okay, can you kill that? So it tells you, really, they were comparable, but there was a louder signal, I think, still at Grayland. It's just that the splatter was louder as well. Okay, why were DXing results poorer from Topino? That's a big question. One of the answers, I think, was the idea that the flag, that I initially had, that the flag delivered a 6 dB greater signal output than the DCAS was mistaken. And I had based that on originally using the original DCAS model, which is a 112-foot baseline. And Bill was actually using a Behemoth, 160-foot baseline. When I looked at the model for the 160-footer, it actually turned out that the flag and the DCAS should be more or less comparable. So I had no advantage for signal strength at Topino with my antenna. The other possibility was the flag being near trees and buildings. I don't know whether I had poorer nulls than I would otherwise have, and I don't know whether just, having trees nearby was actually, lowering the signal level, that there was more loss from having those nearby.
What kind of nulls were you getting?
I don't think I actually evaluated them beyond, sort of just a couple of frequencies. It's sort of probably 15, 20 dB at the outside, and at night that was probably worse.
How big was your flag?
It was standard size. It was 16 feet by 35 feet.
Okay.
That was the sort of original design that was put out. So I think there's more to it than just the flag itself. The other possibility is that, as you can see on this, that I have a couple of lines drawn to Eastern Australia and New Zealand, and they do touch nearby islands. But I didn't really consider that to be a problem when I first looked at the site, and I'm not exactly sure now that it would be a problem. So I actually looked at the flag versus the decals at Grayland a few weeks ago. Same flag, and same decals is what Bill was using. And yeah, the signal levels coming out of it were pretty much similar. That's a discussion, a whole other discussion, of course. But anyway, let's go to the next slide. Now, we had breaking news. This was actually stuff that Mark only got a few days ago, because this only took place a couple of weeks ago. We had a corner fed antenna at both Grayland and at Rockworks. Chuck Hutton used an 18-foot by 18-foot corner fed at Rockworks, and a similar antenna was used at Grayland, aligned in the same direction, 252 degrees true. Annette SDR at Grayland, Perseus at Rockworks again. Next slide, please. Rockworks is known for its excellent New Zealand reception. And how does it compare to Grayland? We've got it about 80 miles north. We compared 3 minutes of files at 1225 UT, 27 June, 2015. And at first hearing, Grayland took a back seat. ZB 1008 was stronger and more readable at Rockworks. Can you play that, please?
Andy from Green Flags Furniture. Is it time for a new round tweak? Then you won one of McDowell's furniture sales. Here at Green Flags, we've got a great range in store. The latest looks, top quality, comfy, and right now, you'll find up to 50% off selected styles. You don't want to miss Green Flags sofa sale. On now. See us today.
Yeah, now that was a fairly consistent 30 to 33 dB out above the out-of-band noise floor at Rockworks. Usually not more than about 25 dB above the noise floor at Grayland. Peaked near 30 briefly. This is the end of the Grayland file, is the beginning of the Rockworks file. You can hear the difference. So there's really not much of a comparison. They were both on the same antenna. I used the corner fed at Grayland that was exactly the same as the one that Chuck was using at Rockworks. Yeah, this was an antenna by antenna comparison. And I the decals was delivering better stuff at the time, and Bruce Portzer was having a great time logging New Zealanders that I wasn't hearing. Okay, so next one, please. However, it's not exactly the same, even though I did one other quick test between the two files, and I heard 29 kilohertz audio on the Rockworks file, and only 17 9 kilohertz. So it's comparative, but it's a subtle difference. It's not like night and day, in spite of what you just heard. And in fact, okay, let's try Rockworks as sport. So, it's there, it's not really usable. Why don't we try Sport 1503 at Grayland?
3 times as much in a year as what star athletes make in the United States. This is going to become a talking point. This is going to become an argument.
Okay, so we have better signal there. It's 40 dB above the noise floor at Grayland and only about 30 at Rockworks. They run U.S. sports to fill the nighttime hours, so I'm not trying to put one over on you.
What did you do anything at the low end of the band?
On this particular...
With Rockworks, yeah.
Yes. Unfortunately, we only had this three-minute file. It took 6 hours for Chuck to pass it to me on Dropbox on the long weekend. At that time, there wasn't much happening on the low band.
You know, there's Pony Express. They can carry DVDs and things.
We sort of thought that this would be faster, and it was, actually. It's just that we didn't want to take until right up to the convention transferring these files. So, yeah, at the time, there wasn't very very good propagation of the lower band at that point. So we can. There were others like ZB 1278 in Tahiti. How did that happen? So, it wasn't exactly you know, Rockworks had the complete advantage in spite of the rumors about it. This is only a 3-minute sample, not entirely equivalent listening setups. As always, more study is needed. We need to do better if we're going to do serious propagation studies. So, next slide. What would be the ideal parallel de-expedition? Yeah. That's interesting. I didn't know about that. Anyway, back to our regularly scheduled program.
That's the advantage of having the control over.
Anyway, what we really want is exactly the same antenna and the receiver at each site. Preferably using a software-defined radio to allow recording the entire band at each site. Listening and recording at exactly the same times, preferably for long enough periods to negate the effects of fading, you know, which are going to affect each site differently. Now, it turns out that Bill Whitaker's actually already done that. And so this long screed that I've been giving you is actually just an introduction to Bill Whitaker's talk, and I'd like to turn the floor over to him at this point.